How was your week?
My week was actually really great. My roommate decided to leave to visit her sister up north for the week. So it's been so, this sounds weird, but it's been so great to like walk around naked in the apartment.
Yeah, that's, and
there's just something so freeing and necessary about naked time. By yourself, I'm not even doing it, just not just from the shower. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a book called How Rude by Dr. Alex J. Packer, who is the guru of manners. And he wrote a book called How Rude. And he also wrote a book called Healthy Highs. And one of them is that sort of just carefree being nude and being in your element is a very important, comforting, natural high.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want this to go in the wrong direction, but in the last few months that I've been a member of the YMCA, for one reason or another, mostly body image issues that I've had, you know, in terms of like my body, obviously, I stopped showering in front of other men in high school. And I avoided and was very meticulous over the years if I were in a situation, well, actually after the Army. So I guess it was in my early 20s, the last time I openly showered with other men. I don't want this to sound terribly weird, but nor should I be worried about it sounding weird because it's definitely not. But there is a kindred spirit among the sort of being within physical proximity of other human beings, whether you're alone and just I'm shedding myself of everything that covers me up in my space that I live, or in public, it's like, dude, and I'm, it's something I'm thinking about. It's like, I'm no longer afraid or ashamed to be in the company of naked people that are, you know, having a similar experience. We're working out, we're getting showered, we're going to go to work, then we'll cover ourselves up later.
Yeah.
But it's kind of played in my favor, I think, recognizing my fear of people and humanity these days, just in terms of the political environment that we're living in now.
Or maybe just being that vulnerable.
Yeah.
I don't see you as being someone that's particularly shy or afraid to be around others, but there is that vulnerability when you're naked and showering.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a reason they made a TV show out of it.
What show?
Naked and Afraid.
Oh, Naked and... Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Right?
I mean, I guess so.
Everything's
I never
harder
of that.
When you're naked.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be.
No.
It's like, you know, and you're going to, by proxy, engage. You look at a person's face when you talk to them, and it's not like I'm like, wait, nice penis. That's, you've got a pretty decently cut penis. You know, but it's just that
right.
which has been so covered up, I guess. So you got to uncover and have some me time.
Yeah. And I did.
Yeah.
I feel not rested, but just emotionally better.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's just something about being by yourself and not having anyone watch you think.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, but I think she comes back today.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be good. It'll be nice to see her again.
And where'd she go?
Just up north, Redding, California.
Oh, I know. Yeah, in Redding. That's
her sister and her niece and nephew live up there.
Coolio.
What about you? What did you do? How was your week?
Well, I went to Quest Diagnostic.
What is that?
Quest Diagnostic is a medical procedure sort of outsourcing company, whereas in the old days when I would go to the doctor, I would have my blood and urine and everything done right at the doctor's office. Quest Diagnostic is a place where doctors now outsource, and I went to Quest Diagnostic, had my blood drawn, had a urine test.
Peed a cup.
Yeah, and it was nice, an opportunity to kind of see how the medical industry is working in our country today and the potential there is. Like, it's kind of orderly and nice and decent, but don't bring your kids. You know, if you've got a couple of kids, I wouldn't recommend that you bring your toddlers to Quest Diagnostics because there's a waiting period. And I had to sit next to a woman and her three kids and all of their toys. And it was like a Montessori school going on. And I kept thinking, as I probably shouldn't do for other people, like, I'm okay with this. I mean, I'm here just at blood work. But what if there's, I mean, like, we're going to test your cancer today at Quest Diagnostics. Like, mommy!
Yeah,
give me book. Ah, don't do that. You know,
and you just think for other people, oh my God, do you do that in the Uber too? This is so random, but sometimes I'll be flipping through the radio and something will come on and I'm so embarrassed by whatever's blaring through the speakers for everyone else in the car. I'm like, this is funny to me, but probably this passenger, this young Latina that just got in, she probably hates the Woody show because they said the word penis on the air.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, it's so embarrassing.
Yeah, the Uber, that's exactly, it's another waiting room.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a different version of like, we don't know each other, we're all strangers here, and I'm thinking for you. And
That's a funny thing we do.
In the Ubers that we drive, I mean, I suppose it's easy enough. Like, I have my Y-Tune shuffle on, so I don't know what's coming up next. I play my music.
Uh-huh.
And I've got some gangster X-rated lyrics that come on, and you know, I quickly change it, but I'm worried about it. But
it's like suddenly everyone's a 4-year-old in the car.
Yeah,
you know.
Then I'm in a waiting room.
They said the F word.
If I'm in an airplane or a waiting room, and I'm feeling like somebody else has made a social choice that's inappropriate for the environment, it takes every ounce of energy for me to keep my mouth shut. And if I do stand up and assume that I'm speaking for the crowd, like, you know, I think I'm speaking for everybody here. Not only do you have your kids, but you've got toys scattered all over here.
Yeah.
Usually people will say, you're not speaking for me, Dave. That's all you.
Well,
no one cares.
Just checking, though. Is everything okay?
Yeah, it's just my annual physical.
Okay,
I recently changed from Blue Cross to Cigna, and I have this job that I work at 32 hours a week, so it's full time, and they've offered me health insurance, which I'm very grateful for. So it's my annual physical.
Good.
Yeah. Well, I'll stay tuned. I mean, who knows?
Well, good.
Yeah.
Well, today's guest is Ryan Duggan, singer-songwriter, radio personality.
Ryan Patrick Duggan.
Ryan
sometimes.
Patrick Duggan.
Yeah.
And he was a great guest.
Mm-hmm.
Political.
Mm-hmm.
So brace yourselves. But I think in post, I tried to keep it as PC as possible.
Well, it's interesting because he does traffic and weather, or just traffic during the overnight?
I think just traffic, but he works with someone that does news and weather.
And that's how I've known Ryan Patrick. My relationship with Ryan Patrick Duggan is based on the fact that's how he was usually announced in years ago when I first heard him on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And he happens to be part of a radio conglomerate, like, you know, the KFI, the sort of AM talk radio. He serves a number of those stations, which I'm very interested in and listen to all the time. You know Ryan in a completely different venue.
Yeah, we met 13 or 14 years ago when I was going through broadcasting school. He was one of my counselors. And actually what's funny is he and I have always stayed in touch. We've always been in contact.
Mm-hmm.
But we used to party together. And recently I went through an old photo album and there were just all of these ridiculous pictures of the two of us red-faced and drunk.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's been fun to watch him grow up and have a kid and see his career bloom and blossom. And I mean, he'll talk all about that. But
yes, he will.
Ryan Duggan. Hey, so we got another show.
We are. Y-Tune Shuffle. Maggie Mayfield is here.
David Earl Waterman is here, too. And our special guest, Ryan.
Very special guest.
Duggan. I think.
Ryan Duggan.
I got a very special out of it.
I think both of us have a little crush on you.
A little crush. You know, you can go both ways today, you know.
Well, you're both very attractive people.
Aww.
Thank you.
Yes,
yeah, well, yes. Already we're in like Flynn.
This is getting sexy.
Are you Irish? Ryan, are you an Irish? Duggan?
I am. I'm about 2/3 Irish.
Okay. Duggan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. My middle name's Patrick, so.
Yeah, very good, very good.
It's a little.
Fucking nice to have you here.
And he's drinking whiskey out of his coffee cup.
We're not at all stereotypical here.
The magic of radio.
Already.
So, Ryan, tell us a little bit about what you do.
What I do? Well, I am a radio person. I don't know if you'd call it a personality. I do news and traffic for a series of iHeartMedia stations in Los Angeles. So,
most infamously
KFI. I'm the overnight guy there that does traffic, along with Michael Crozier, who does the news. and it's during Coast to Coast AM. So,
oh, God, I love Coast to Coast.
I do too.
Do you listen all night long, every show?
Well, I wish I could listen. Unfortunately, I'm doing a few other stations at the same time. So
see, that's
really
what I don't understand as a radio lover. And there's obviously tons of us out there. The radio audience is alive, and despite podcasting and all the internet sort of access, good old-fashioned AM radio is what I listen to driving around this town.
Yeah, and I don't think it'll ever go away in a sense that it's something that I listen to all the time and people that I know listen to all the time. And you hear people, you know, prognosticate. They give it a poor prognosis as far as the future goes for radio. They say everything's going to be on a new technology and everybody will be just listening to apps. But I still think people in the cars are going to listen to radio forever.
And 24-hour traffic. I mean, last night we had the truck that lost the bananas. Were you on top of that story?
I wasn't working last night, but it made me a little sad that I missed the banana truck.
Yeah, the truck on the 210 outside the Sunland exit. Boom.
I will tell you, a few months back, I did get a truck on the 71 that overturned, and it was carrying porta-potties from a festival. So shut down the 71 in Pomona. And I felt really bad for the...
What a shitty
hazmat
situation.
Crew. That's what I said. Yeah. I said, you know, there was only so many ways I could say that on KFI. I like that.
But that's not all that he does.
No,
Ryan
far from it.
So many talents. In fact, you just announced that you have your second album.
I do. Mm-hmm. I do. It's going to come out March 24th. It's called A Congregation of Strangers. It's pretty good if you like the singer-songwriter thing.
Mm-hmm. So you wrote, recorded, produced the whole thing?
Yep. Played all the instruments, wrote, recorded, produced, all that stuff.
And the album cover art?
Yep. Everything. Top to bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Where do we see it?
Well, you can listen to my first record right now. It's called The Sentimentalist. It's available on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon, everywhere. You can just check it out.
It's a cliche question, but what are your influences? How did you get involved? When did you recognize that you had a special sort of connection to music, wanted to do it?
Oh, I think that went early. It went really, really early on. I was kind of a latchkey kid. I was left on my own most of the time. I was with my father. And,
where? What town? L.A.?
I kind of bounced around, but for the vast majority of my life when I came out here, it was in Seal Beach. Mm. And Seal Beach is kind of a nice little upscale Orange County Beach community now, but it was a little bit different when I was growing up, which was 30-some-odd years ago. And I was left alone a lot. And my dad used to come home around 8 or 9 at night. He worked at construction. And so from the time I was really young, from first grade on, I would be walking home and entertaining myself and making my own dinner. And I was kind of I was kind of a strange kid in the sense that, you know, now they have terminology for it. They probably would be saddling me with some sort of strange spectrum terminology, and they would probably, put me on medication of some kind. But back then, I just got into listening to the radio, and I dreamed of making music someday. It was the only thing that seemed cool when I was 6 years old.
So music became, you recognized very early that music was an important part of who you are as a person, and you connected with it six years old.
I think so. It's hard to remember clearly what I was thinking at 6 years old, but I know that we didn't have cable, and I wasn't really into television very much. So when I got cable a few years later, all of that changed. It was like a whole new world, and then I was a 9-year-old kid watching HBO and Cinemax when I shouldn't have been, and, you know, hardcore relationship dramas at 8 or 9 years old. Most kids
the Hitchhiker
cartoons.
Series.
Yeah.
Things got semi-pornographic.
Things got a little weird, but there was no supervision.
I was there, buddy.
No supervision. But for me, I think that the radio was the only thing that I had, and my dad had a lot of stuff on cassettes, and cassettes were still relatively new at the time. That's how old I am, and we had 8 tracks, too. But my dad had a lot of stuff on cassettes, and I think that in a weird way, the stuff that I used to listen to with him driving around in his work truck was stuff that I gravitated to at home. And so I would listen to music there a lot, and then I would flip around the radio stations and listen to that. And I had this little tiny radio that I had in my bedroom. And when I went to bed at night, I used to put it under my pillow because I wasn't supposed to be listening to it. And I would stay up late till 10 o'clock and listen to Wolfman Jack, because Wolfman Jack, they would play. He broadcasted out of Tijuana at the time.
Wow.
So they would play this stuff out of the station. I can't remember what it was. It was X96 or something. I don't remember what the station was now. It's been long defunct. But that was this whole entire other world to me. So my two loves sort of intersected. I loved radio from a young age and loved music from a young age.
And Wolfman Jack being one that was just so connected to wanting his listeners to know what they were listening to, and then adding that personal element to what he was feeling during it. I mean, you know Wolfman Jack, right, mm-hmm. Maggie?
Yeah.
I mean,
They have an exhibit of him at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, an American Graffiti. There, yeah. I mean, it's immortalized mm-hmm. through that film. Wow. And what was your dad listening to?
You know, he was a big fan of things like Lynyrd Skynyrd. Got a lot of Springsteen from my dad, which is, that's been with me my whole entire life. I'm not so much a Skynyrd fan, but I like Lynyrd Skynyrd, but, you know, I wouldn't put them on the pantheon of great artists. They're not on my personal Mount Rushmore, if you will. But he listened to a lot of Springsteen, a lot of sort of what would later become alt country. So rock bands with a bit of a twang to them, you know. I guess Southern rock too, a lot of Allman Brothers, growing up in my house, a little bit of the Grateful Dead.
Okay.
And some blues influenced stuff.
Were your parents like, did they smoke weed?
My dad did a little bit. My dad did a little bit of everything.
Do you remember like when you found out that he did drugs? Like, do you remember how old you were?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I remember a number of times there were some jail stints and things of the sort. So that made it a little bit difficult, you know, when I would go to bed and he hadn't come home from work yet and I'd get up the next day and he wasn't there. And I eventually had to call some relatives and try to figure it out and they would track him down and he was in the drunk tank or something else. So he had a bit of a problem with a few things. And I remember several times seeing paraphernalia laying out that he and his friends would be partying all night and they couldn't bother to pick up. But, you know, I mean, he was 19, 20 years old when I was born.
Yeah.
He was partying with his friends. It was one of those things.
Yeah,
too. How did you feel? Do you remember? Because that's an interesting question. How did you feel the first time you kind of put it together that your parents were smoking weed?
I was much older. I was like in my 20s.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, oh, that makes sense. Why everyone thought I smelled like weed all the time. Because they also smoked cigarettes. So I just thought it was the same thing. Okay. I had no idea.
Because my stepdad, he sold weed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and had a heroin problem, you know, way before it was in vogue and everybody went to rehab. I mean, he struggled. It was in the, you know, post-Vietnam, sort of right at the tail end of Vietnam era. And horse was around, but it just didn't have the exposure that it has today. I can't quite recall, other than just acknowledging and maybe sharing with a few friends, this is what my stepdad does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I don't feel that the impact, I don't recall the impact being earth-shattering or causing me to have to go talk to the counselor at school. It was like, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, obviously it had an effect. I'm in therapy now, but I think many things have an effect. But I don't, that specifically, I'm really trying to think, like, I thought it was cool, I think. Honestly, I thought it was kind of a cool thing.
Yeah. What was the first instrument that you played, that you learned how to play?
Besides the, what do you call the little recorder thing that you have in school?
Hot cross buns.
Which, I remember that thing.
Which is pretty epic. I mean, it was great to know how to play something like that. You talk about it.
I can still
play. Because we all sucked equally. That's the thing.
But the thing is, I've always wondered whether or not someone was so inspired by that moment that they took it all the way. And they're in their 40s now. And they're just
still playing the recorder.
Just hitting that recorder. Just trying to find session bands.
They're in a Jethro Tull cover band.
Right. You know, I mean, because that's the stuff they hand out. They hand out recorders and triangles and everything else.
Yeah,
and maybe that's your first love and you've never
That's funny. That's another sketch.
Yeah, that has to be. You know, just a bunch of people with the elementary school instruments.
We're having
just
a pitch meeting here at Y-Tune Shuffle.
Doing like new covers with old instruments like that. That'd be fantastic.
Actually, yes.
Yeah. So that was probably the first musical instrument that I played, like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
As far as reaching out on my own, you know, I remember a couple friends of mine when I was about 11 or 12 that had guitars. You know, we were all skaters and surfers. And a couple people, my friend Todd Mertz, who I lost contact with and for a number of years, and he recently reached out to me once again. He was the first guy that I knew that really played guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going over to his house going, whoa, you have a guitar. I mean, to me, it was like the sword of destiny. It was this fantastic thing that I had never known any other kid that did that. And I dreamed about it. In my head, I was doing that for years already. In my head, I was like the kid with the tennis racket in front of the mirror singing along to Springsteen records. You know, I was sure that that's where my path was headed, but I didn't know how to get a guitar. You know, I mean, I didn't have a lot of money growing up, or, you know, the idea that a guitar would find its way into my hands was crazy at that age. And I had a couple of friends because I grew up in an area where people did have money, unlike my family. And a couple of my friends had guitars, and Todd was the first one, and I just sat there. He knew how to play three or four songs, and I was mesmerized. Mm. And it was like, I tried so hard to figure out a way to get a guitar. I didn't have a job. I didn't have anything else. And so finally, I ended up trading a skateboard that I had to a friend of mine for a guitar that he didn't use. I remember playing with it a little bit, and it didn't sound right.
You know, electric guitar or acoustic?
It was electric guitar. The first guitar that I had was an electric guitar. And it was an Ibanez electric, and it was a piece of crap. I mean, it was like made out of balsa wood, you know, just this crappy, you know, thing that should be sold for $35 in a Sears catalog.
I was just thinking Sears catalog. Yeah. Like,
oh no,
that
it was
photo.
Terrible. It was exactly like that. And you know what's funny is, I remember playing it in standard tuning and going, this doesn't make sense. You know, I don't know how to play any chords or anything like that. And so I learned how to open tune it. I played around and learned how to open tune it. So it's sort of, you know, you can open tune it to an E or a C or anything like that. And I started playing around with it. And then it totally made sense to me. And worlds started opening up. And I think that I got it pretty quickly. You know, nobody had to sit down and teach me how to do that. It was weird. It was just one of those things that...
Wonders of youth.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it is. It's just like trying to learn a language when you're a kid. I teach my 10-year-old something and he learns it so fast. Yeah, he's playing guitar now. And he picks up stuff so quickly. It's insane.
And that was happening to you.
Yeah. And so it's one of those things, but I never had somebody to sit and teach me how
to
play.
Did you get a band going, garage band, anything like that?
You know, by the time I was 13 or 14, I was doing that.
Name of the band? Do you remember?
Oh, wow. Okay. There's a few. There's a band called 13 Lost that I was in, which was pretty awesome. It was really loud. You know, the funniest thing is that you know, when you sit in, I mean, when you start... I'm making friends that play music in junior high school, middle school, junior high school. You know, at the time, you got to think this was, let me see here, in the late 80s for me.
Yeah.
So the stuff that people were listening to was like Rat and Winger and L.A.
Brian Adams. That's like a knife.
Well, I mean, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, Brian Adams, I would have been more comfortable with Brian Adams. Something poppier or rootier was more in my wheelhouse. My friends wanted to take it to metal or punk rock right away. That was not you. Yeah, that's what it was about.
Yeah, it was
and
so cool.
You know, if you were 13 years old and you were writing Brian Adams kind of songs, that'd be kind of weird, right? You know?
Weirdly cool.
Yeah. Well, I think it would be, but I don't think that most people would have thought it would be.
True.
You know?
True.
And I was sort of embarrassingly influenced by my friends at that age. I mean, I just desperately wanted to play music and they wanted to play heavy music. And I thought this will be my chance to play music no matter what it was. Mm-hmm. So I had a band called 13 Lost. I had a band that played a kind of a horror punk thing called the Scariotypes. And it was, you know, that was partly influenced by horror and science fiction films that I loved. And we just did a sort of Misfits-esque thing, you know, that was punk rock and had a...
You got to contact Dana Gould and do a show.
Yeah.
Like, Scariotypes.
Yeah, I love Dana Gould's podcast. It's so good.
And he's got a show on FX now or something like that, Scary Show.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I love that stuff. And I still love that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a 12-year-old kid in my head.
Yeah.
I still...
Fuck yeah.
I never...
Scariotypes!
No, it was... And you know, the thing is that when you're that age, you have no insecurity or no fear. You just stand up there and you think you're the coolest motherfucker in the world. You're 14 years old. You know what I mean? Like, what do I know about life? And I'm singing about it. Like,
how does that happen? I mean, because you do in a weird way. There's this genetics maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is that I wish it gave me some sort of street cred along, you know, in my junior high school or my middle school. But most people just sort of stared at me. It was already weird enough that I was one of those people who started puberty really early, so I had facial hair and stuff at 13 years old.
Wow.
Which is fine now, but when you're 13, you know who doesn't like that? Girls.
Oh, gosh.
It was so weird. So I felt like the hairy weird kid who was starting a punk rock band. And I'm like 40 now and I still kind of feel like the hairy weird kid who plays music and does the vampire shift overnight. So
That makes sense. Yeah. It's all coming together. Right.
So you brought five songs to the table that somehow inspire you or trigger some pretty awesome memories that you feel like sharing.
Yeah. Tell us why.
By the way, I want to say something. of all the things that I've had to do in my life, this is one of the more difficult tasks I've ever undertaken. This is
every show.
Five songs.
It's the SAT of podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, naming my son was easier. It's just crazy. But yeah, I did. I brought five songs. So, you know, just like you asked me to.
Well, let's dive into number one.
All right, the first song is a song that I remember hearing in my father's work truck, and it's a song that I heard all throughout my youth, and it's the title track off of Bruce Springsteen's The River record. As a songwriter, it's kind of interesting. When you write a song, there's different stages of a song. So there's that moment where you write it, and, you know, whatever inspires you to write it, and you're writing the lyrics, and you're getting the melodies together, and then if you have a band, there's that moment where you teach it to your band, and they all add in their own stuff there. And then you finally put it down on a record, and that's supposed to be the version that you grow old with. But the truth of the matter is, it's weird because you play it every night in front of people over and over and over and over again. And songs mean something different over time, and they mean something different to everybody else. So they're part of this weird omniverse. Like, I don't know if that works the same way with anything that you've ever written, but you ever write something 10 or 15 years ago, and you look back at it now and the whole entire meaning has changed, and you don't even know whether or not you meant that at the time. Well, that's what I love about this song, is that year after year, how I heard it when I was a kid, the idea of this sort of desperate relationship between a couple. Bruce Springsteen wrote it about his sister, but relationship between a couple where his sister was pregnant as a teenager, and it's very, very sad in the sense that his brother-in-law ended up marrying her and getting a union card and a wedding coat, as they say in the song. And fast forward 10 or 12 years later in this song, and their only happiness is looking back to the time before all of that happened, before unemployment was just crushing them, before the weight of life was just crushing them and trying to raise kids was crushing them. And their happiness was looking back to a time when they used to have their dreams still ahead of them. And I think Springsteen writes a lot about the distance between the dream or the American dream or someone's personal dream and the reality, the measure of the distance that takes. So let me throw this one on here.
I come from down in the valley where Mr.
You said that it has a different meaning today than it did when you first heard it. What was the meaning when you first heard it?
Well, I think when I was 5 or 6 years old and I was hearing this song, I heard the idea that it comes from a place and, you know, you're supposed to do what your father does. Like there's this idea that you're rooted in this small town, which you sung about a lot. And I didn't see how sad it was because I don't think I was capable of looking at life that way as a child. Yeah. And the older that you get, and the more you try to, no matter what you're doing, if you're trying to make it in Los Angeles on your own, you're trying to raise kids, life is difficult. It's not something that is easy to do for most people. You know, I mean, some people manage to find a way through and make their dreams come true very easily. And, you know, they're on that rocket and they get to where they're going and they're able to do everything they want to do. But, you know, there's a lot of struggle and a lot of turmoil there. And I think that what I find so amazing about listening to that song 30 some odd years later is the way that he would dignify a pretty common experience, a pretty common struggle.
Dignify that experience.
I mean, to
validate it.
And to sort of give life and voice to these characters, and they're real characters, they're real people, but to give them a voice is a pretty special thing to do, in the sense that it's real easy to write about wanting to be famous or wanting to be, you know, in love or any of these themes that we all write about. But the idea that you can write about something that is painful and still talk about the fact that somehow, some way, people find a way to endure, even under difficult circumstances. And in my own life, I think that that's pretty magical now when I look back on that. And I see my own upbringing in that a little bit. I see the irony of the fact that my mother was a teenager when she had me, and my father was a union sheet metal worker who was in and out of work at times, you know, because the Reaganomics were pretty difficult on people in the unions. And He was in and out of work at times. And I also saw the crisis that that brought, as far as, you know, you were talking about drug addiction and alcoholism and stuff like that earlier. It's a real crisis of masculinity, I think, when you can't feel like you can provide or something, especially then for a family. And I saw the number that that did on him psychologically. And so every line in there is sort of searing into my skull about how difficult that can be. And
when you were younger, when you heard that song, was that to you like, I'm going to be like my dad and I'm going to be a sheet metal worker? And I obviously am not a man, but from what I understand of the male ego, it's like dad is super important and what dad thinks and being like your dad. And that is really deep rooted, I think, in a lot of men. I mean, correct me if I'm
hard
wrong.
Hard to avoid. Mm-hmm. I mean,
you know, I think for me, part of that was because my father was working really long hours and I spent so much time alone. It wasn't a Norman Rockwell home. So mm-hmm. I thought that that's what men did. They worked really hard.
It was just you and your dad?
It was just me and my dad.
Wow.
No siblings?
I have a younger brother, but he's my half brother, and he was sort of in and out of my younger life too. And he's my half brother on my mother's uh-huh. child. And I had another brother who passed away. But I don't know if it was so much that I wanted to be like my dad, but I think it was the idea that there's a natural trajectory there for sure. That's all I knew of the world. Mm-hmm. So I assumed that's what you grew up and that's what you did.
You grew up
and you became a sheet metal worker and you were out of work sometimes and you drank and you, you watched baseball and that was life.
What was his team?
When we were out here, he was a Dodger fan. I think that that's been, if there is a family heirloom, not as cool as your family heirloom, but if there is a family heirloom, it wasn't smoking weed, but it's the Dodgers. I mean, it was one of the things that, it was something that I could always talk to him about.
What was your dad's name?
John.
John Duggan.
And
John Duggan.
Something that I could always talk to him about. You know, that and Bruce Springsteen were the two things that were, that nice. Intersected. They were always common there.
So. I like it.
But that's what it is. So
number one song, and you did very well. We started out like a little bit high, and we get high, Maggie and I, off just mm-hmm. hearing the song, mm-hmm. and then relating to the guests. Like this is an intimate experience we're having with you, right? and then just pot it down halfway, so there's a little bit playing underneath.
Okay, so the Rolling Stones.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Between say 68 and 75, 76, mm-hmm. I mean, they put out some of the best records, you know, that you could ever possibly, Exile on Main Street, Let It Bleed. I mean, there's so many albums there. And this, of course, is a song millions of people have heard, but I think it's the greatest opening 30 seconds in rock and roll history. And when I got a guitar, this was all I wanted to do.
Hit it.
This is everything.
I fucking love the Stones.
Now, isn't it?
I mean, it's orchestral. You're talking about four blokes from fucking England, just really punks,
Yeah.
And the arrangement to lead into a theme. Why this tune?
You know, there are a myriad of Rolling Stones songs that I could choose. You know, it's probably not my favorite Stones song, but I'll tell you, I think that it's one of those things that even if you're just a casual Stones fan, that it just grabs you right away. And you talk about side one, track ones. Everybody always has that thing, like how an album starts, and mm-hmm. there's all things that are memorable. But that's, to me, that intro is still as good. I think that everybody who plays a guitar and has a little tremolo on it, little effect on it, you know, playing with something, playing with chorus, playing with flanger, trying to do something that captures a feeling, is still chasing that sound 40 years later. And Keith Richards, you know, to me, it's funny because he's a punchline to a lot of people. You know, a lot of people like to make fun of his accent.
He's still
like
alive.
And we can't do any more drugs because Keith has done them all. I mean, how many comics have you heard make that joke, right?
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, if you watch him, There's no separation between him and his instrument. It's just like this fluid movement. He's the most natural guitar player ever. And, you know, as great as somebody like Eddie Van Halen is, or as great as a lot of virtuoso instrumentalists might be, there's a feel that Keith Richards plays with that to me, and I play a Telecaster also, you know, like he did a lot of the time, but it is still the cleanest, most beautiful sound I've ever heard come out of an electric guitar. And it's absolutely magical. That song's a pretty heavy song, you know. I mean, it's talking about bombs raining down on England, and it's talking about, you know, his childhood, and obviously London was just devastated. You know, it's still, there's something haunting and beautiful and magic, but there's movement in the whole entire thing. Like, you can hear the whole band come in and play together, and you hear little notes, you know, little piano notes that'll strike down on the E. And the background vocals that you hear, it's just everything about that song moves. And it's still, to this day, I've heard that song 2,000 times at least, and it still moves me every single time that I hear it.
Do you remember the first time you heard it?
Oh, yeah. I was young. I was young and probably listening to Wolfman Jack show. I mean, that opening riff just grabbed me. It's been grabbing me my whole entire life. It's been haunting me my whole entire life. Yeah, I'm a big fan. I still remain a big fan. And to me, that guitar sound is still the sound that I'm chasing. Mm-hmm. That magical thing that I first saw at my friend Todd Merce's house when I saw him, you know, sort of hammering his way through three or four chords and playing, you know, some sort of song that he was into. I just was mesmerized. And it sounded close enough to the Rolling Stones or groups that I grew up listening to, that it was enough to make me do whatever I could to get a guitar. It's such a simple thing. I mean, how many people do you know that play the guitar a little bit? There's like
almost everyone.
Almost everyone, yeah. Right? And yet it's this thing. It's this, if I told you, you know, I mean, you know, you think of the amount of protest music that you hear, you think of movements like a punk rock movement or an energetic movement. I mean, the guitar has been responsible for so many insane movements in American culture, you know, I mean, really around the world, I'm sure, but in this culture. And if I told you that people died because of this instrument, and people spent their whole entire lives trying to perfect this thing, and people, you know, there were hearings with the PMRC and you know, Tipper Gore and that whole entire thing in the 80s, because they thought that heavy metal music was bad for the youth and punk rock music was bad for the youth. And that's how we got the warning labels on them and stickers. It was so dangerous, rock and roll, that it comes with a warning label. That's how dangerous it is. If I told you something like that, you would think I was talking about some mythical instrument. Mm-hmm. And it's just a guitar.
Right.
It's just a thing with six strings on it that people learn how to play. And yet it means so much.
Absolutely. It's an interesting context. Absolutely.
I've never even thought of it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a guitar, right? Mm-hmm. It's a little thing that people do.
But it's not!
It's just a thing that you know, you get stoned and you do when you're 14 or 15 and try to impress.
A girl. Yeah. Yep.
My imitation of everybody playing guitar that's not going to go further. Wait.
I'll tell you. Even if somebody's slightly more advanced in that stage, I spent a summer working at Guitar Center, and it was torturous.
Wait,
I
mean,
I'm sure whatever people go through, you know, before we banned waterboarding and everything else, it couldn't have been any worse than that summer working at Guitar Center. Because, I mean, at the time, you know how many people, Wayne's World made the Stairway to Heaven joke, you know, Stairway. Yeah. But there were four or five songs that you would hear people pick over and over and over again and do them badly. So it was like working.
Do you remember them?
Well, I remember at the time, Metallica, Enter Sandman, people kept playing that song over and over again. And I wasn't the biggest fan of that song. And I certainly wasn't the biggest fan of that song when it was played terribly and clumsily over and over and over and over and over again. And I was losing my mind. And you know, you want to sell guitars, so you can't walk over and start screaming.
Stop!
Yeah.
Stop it!
Right.
That's interesting that multiple people kept coming in to play the same thing.
Oh, it's just one of those things.
Equally as badly.
When you ask somebody at Guitar Center now, you get, you ask someone what time it is at Guitar Center, they'll tell you how to build a watch, that old joke, you know? I mean, somebody will give you way more information than you need to know. I just took my son to buy his first acoustic guitar. He had been playing electric guitar first, and so he got this great Fender acoustic that is really, really good, and I had to check it out and make sure there was no damage on it, no dead spots on it, that the action was good and everything else. And this guy's trying to upsell my 10-year-old kid.
I'm going, dude,
I'm sorry your life didn't work out. I've been that guy. Good Lord.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's as much as I love guitar, that almost ruined my love of guitar. I was like, maybe I don't want to play music anymore.
Oh,
you know, I don't know. It's pretty bad.
Yeah. Yep. Let's go on to song number three.
Shall we move on? All right. Let's see here. Okay, let me give you a little bit of background here just for 1 second.
Excellent.
One of my first radio jobs was outside of Spokane, Washington. It was during the winter when I moved there. It was colder than a well digger's ass for 2 or 3 months. It was so cold, black ice everywhere. I was a, you know, stranger in a strange town. And, you know, that's how the radio thing goes, of course.
Yep.
That's how it works. But, you know, one of the things that made me nostalgic for home was the music that I listened to. And I wanted to get back to LA so bad. And thankfully, I got hired at iHeart or Clear Channel at the time. It was a few months after that, and I was able to come back. But I used to listen to Warren Zevon all the time because Warren Zevon is like on my LA. He is the quintessential Los Angeles artist in many ways. You can make an argument for Tom Waits and a few other people. You know, Van Halen's a great LA band. You know, there's a lot of great LA artists, but Warren Zevon for me.
Not often the case.
Yeah.
I mean, recognized.
Yeah. So, and the fact that Warren Zevon, you know, is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is an absolute travesty. It is a tragedy of Elizabethan proportions. It is something that irks me to this day. Not that I really care who's in the Rock and Roll Fame, but clearly
still,
I do. It's just weird. You see some of the people that are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and somebody who's this great songwriter who has influenced so many people. And in fact, I put a Warren Zevon song. The one cover that I've recorded to put on an album is I recorded Carmelita on my first album called The Sentimentalist, because Warren Zevon had died and was always this huge fan of his. And one of my great moments was having people in his family reach out to me, his ex-girlfriend reach out to me, send me her book and everything else, and really tell me they loved my cover of Warren Zevon's song.
Wonderful.
So that was unreal.
That's nice.
That was
that's
super,
really nice.
Super cool.
Super cool.
So yeah, let me put on this song.
Okay.
It's one of the things that makes me think of LA.
The sun refused to shine. Never thought I'd have to pay so dearly for what was already mine.
One of the great lyricists.
Yeah.
Such a long, long time.
I mean, do you think it's by his choice? Like, did he not chase it as much as others did? Or was he satisfied at a certain level?
You know, it's really hard to say. I don't know if he had... I know he didn't make a lot of music videos in the age of music video, and that may have been some of it. He may have been someone who was... he's a bit of a polemicist. He's a bit of someone who you know... probably spent some time train wrecking his own career on purpose.
You think so?
You know, I have a little bit of that in myself. I don't know where that comes from. You know, self-destructive impulse.
I'm only a year into therapy. I couldn't comment yet, but... but I can relate. Oh, boy. But why this tune in particular? You know the one everybody is going to immediately identify Warren Zevon was Werewolves of London.
Yeah.
Undeniably fucking piece of work, man.
No, it's incredible. It's an incredible song. You know, there's so many songs that he wrote about being in L.A., sort of a down-and-out character being in L.A., but unlike Springsteen or Dylan or somebody like that, you always got the sense that he was talking about himself. Like, his songs were autobiographical to the point of self-indulgence a lot of the time, because he would talk about living in the Hollywood Hawaiian Hotel, which he did. He was a quintessential LA artist, and he was somebody that I really wanted to find a way home. And it was that and the Tom Waits Small Change record that I listened to over and over and over and over again. And a little bit of Jane's Addiction, too, because that was the influence of my friend Todd Mertz, the guy I was telling you about that played guitar. The first, I remember him, you know, he had an electric and an acoustic, and the one thing that he played really well was Jane's Sets by Jane's Addiction, which is a great song. It's a
phenomenal we opened up song. Sketch comedy shows in Boston to that song.
That's a great song. So that could have very easily been my choice as well.
What was it like living in Spokane? What was your living situation? What were the who'd you hang out with?
A couple people that worked at the station kind of started dating somebody that I hung out with a little bit. It was a strange time. I mean, I really kind of felt, you know, I'll be really, really honest. I had a bit of a drug problem for years before that. And I spent a lot of time there because I was in a strange city and worried about relapsing. I spent a lot of time going to meetings then, you know, just kind of working that program and trying to be a normal person who could show up to work every day. And
show up,
So it was important to me. I mean, and, you know, it's funny. I still use some lessons that I learned from that. I never was big into AA for the most part or any of that stuff, but I still think it's a cool idea that here these people sit around, they huddle around in the storm of their sickness, whatever it is, and who cares about what the book says or what the program is? Like, the fact that these people who are broken, and we're all broken to a certain extent, show up for one another was the magic thing for me. So I made some friends in that program.
Oh, that, you know, program. For me, you know, I went in and I went in and out in Boston, and and it was Hollywood that I learned quite a bit. And there's a number of us that, if I'm understanding where you're at now, it's been a long time since I've gone to a meeting, but the lessons and the gift. And today I was on the phone with a guy in Thailand who I know through the rooms, and I haven't been to him. I go sporadically just to say hello. It's kind of like the people that go to church on Christmas Eve.
Yes. Right.
You know, I'll go take a cake for, I'm 21 years without a drink or any drug because of that program. And I agree. I learned a lot. And today I was on the phone with a guy freaking out in Thailand. You know, he said, I want a fucking drink, you know? Yeah. And, and we're still there. So Spokane was kind of, I got a dog. I didn't go anywhere, but I got a fucking dog. Bought me 12 years of sobriety.
But, you know, that is the magic. I mean, the fact that somebody can, that you can talk to after after all that time and reach out.
It works.
And it is, and that's the thing. I think that people have different experiences in that kind of program. And the reason people do whatever they do sometimes is because there's always something broken in them. But the fact of the matter is that people show up for each other, even damaged people that show up for each other in any context. It's a pretty amazing thing.
It's just without any pretense. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Spokane, so, drying out.
Luckily, I didn't spend that much time there.
How long have you been back in L.A.?
Oh, 11, 12 years. I've been working for the same company, one version or another. Well, I got fired for 3 weeks, but other than that.
That's hilarious.
Oh, yeah, I got fired for tweeting something, too, so it's the funniest thing in the world.
Wow.
I did. I used to, I used to be the morning news guy for KRLA, which is Salem Station, but we had the contract for the Salem Station, and I tweeted out something about Adam Lambert, the pop star Adam Lambert. Now, some background here. I had never really heard Adam Lambert. I'd only seen Adam Lambert and listened to a track or two, you know, and he had just won or came in second.
American Idol.
American
yeah.
Idol,
yeah.
Right?
I thought he won it. I'm not sure.
I mean, whatever it was. I've never really watched a lot of it. But at the time, there was this Splash pop-up that kept coming up every time I tried to sign into my Twitter, and they don't do that anymore. But for a while, they experimented with these little pop-up ads that came up. And it was for Adam Lambert's album, you know, this Adam Lambert's album. And I was getting so annoyed. And so finally, so, and this is like 2009, I think, or 2010, maybe. I don't know. I was getting so annoyed that finally I tweeted out, I don't want to buy Adam Lambert's album. I wouldn't, you know, or I don't want to follow him either, because it was saying follow Adam Lambert. I wouldn't follow him unless it was into a burning building to shut the door behind him.
Oh! Like,
and so immediately,
which is funny,
just
but...
everything just blew up. Like, you know, so I had thousands of messages of people assuming that it was a homophobic remark, and it was not a homophobic remark in any way at all. It was like
horrifying.
And I said over and over again, this is an insert crappy pop star here joke. That's all it was. It was a lazy insert crappy pop star here joke, but they wouldn't hear it. People
wouldn't
hear it.
Was that scary? Were you freaking out on
it? I was really freaking out because I got a number of messages.
I would have been fucking freaking
out. First of all, the station fired me within 24 hours of that. I took it down and the station fired me within 24 hours because we got so many calls. I got so many calls down there, so many emails, this massive Twitter campaign, this massive campaign on his website about what a...
About you?
About what a terrible person I am and how homophobic
wow.
I am. And,
that's a fucking nightmare.
Like over and over and over again. And here I am. I mean, anybody that has known me forever,
yeah.
I'm about as progressive as you can get. Like... It had nothing to do with anything of the sort other than I felt like I was inundated with some pop star that I didn't want to be inundated with.
This is a great example of how young people today do not fully comprehend how fucking powerful the media is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's Goebbels stuff, fucking Nazi Germany stuff. Probably. Mm-hmm. You can blow up. I'm sorry. Continue.
No, it was a really terrifying time for me. I mean, it really, really was. And I thought that I was going to lose my job. I did lose my job. I was suspended, technically not fired, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. And then I knew I wasn't going to be able to be back on the Salem stations. Now, the irony of this at a time is we still do some Salem station, so I guess I should be a little careful here. But the truth of the matter is, at the time, you know, KRLA is a conservative Christian talk station, okay? The very week that they had suspended me for that, they had given out media personality of the year awards and stuff like that, and they had made this big to-do about giving Ann Coulter an award. And so...
Ooh.
I couldn't believe that these two things were happening simultaneously, that Ann Coulter was being given an award at the station at this banquet at the Alex Theater in Glendale, but they're firing me for being homophobic. It was the strangest feeling in the world, and it was surreal. It was like I was in the
Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's exactly what it was. And if you try, when waves are hitting you over and over again, you try explaining yourself, it just made it worse. You know, I don't know how algorithms
so
work.
So out of context.
So this is just more proof that marketing and Facebook ads work.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
they work.
Yeah, it's the power. And I mean, my heart goes out to you. I mean, I get so riled when I say something in a fucking simple thread that 8 people look at.
Oh, yeah.
I can only imagine.
Oh, I can't deal with looking at Facebook or looking at those kinds of things in an election year because people lose mm-hmm. their minds.
I hope your next song is a bit more uplifting.
I would say that's so interesting that it was like 2008, you said? 2009?
2009, maybe 2010. I don't remember when it was exactly.
I was going to say, because Twitter was not a big deal yet.
Yeah, no, it was early on.
Yeah,
it
was the same
thing. That's so fascinating. A long fucking time ago.
So it was early on. That's what I was saying before. It was early on.
I was like, I don't think Twitter is even 10 years old yet.
And I think that it was one of those things where I couldn't believe it. And I took it down. You know what's funny is I took it down probably an hour after I posted it. One comment, one flippant remark, one thing said the wrong way can legitimately destroy somebody's life. And even if it's not intended that way. So it was a lesson for me in the sense that it hurt me a lot personally. My feelings were hurt because to be accused of something like that was really heart-wrenching for me because that is so antithetical to who I am and what I represent as a person. And having hundreds and hundreds of people over and over again call you homophobic is a weird thing. And no matter how much you protest or insist that you're not, again, it's like a wave hitting you over and over and over again.
Well, I was just saying, well, let me tell you, it's not any easier with a set of boobs.
No,
I don't think so. No.
I get questioned on everything that I post.
And that's your job.
Mm-hmm.
You got like.
We still have 2 more songs, Mr. Duggan.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
We get on that here. Okay. So,
Warren.
So, we went from Warren Zevon. Now, let me give you another little background thing here. As I told you, when I started playing in bands, I started playing in these really loud bands when I was younger. And then I eventually started playing punk rock. And I eventually started playing this sort of rock ska hybrid. I mean, I was playing with all sorts of people who wanted to play that kind of music.
Like Mighty Mighty Boss Tones?
Yeah,
kind of stuff.
Yeah. Sort of early version of that sort of ska core sound. And the first band that I was ever in that had a little bit of success on that level was a ska core band like that. And the experience was very strange. Touring for the first time and playing in front of people that I didn't know and seeing cities that I didn't know. It was really, really cool. But I totally had this Kurt Cobain style freak out.
You were touring with your band.
Yeah, I was touring with my band.
Name?
It was named El Scorcho at the time. It was before. Yeah, no, it was named El Scorcho. But the thing is that right after we were called El Scorcho, I think a year later, Weezer put out a single called El Scorcho. And so people kept connecting and it was bothering me a lot. But we did a little bit of a small amount of playing up and down and touring and playing with bigger bands, you know, bands that became a lot bigger afterwards. You know, we were playing with groups like the Ataris all the time,
Whoa.
Who later became huge, and we played with Kara's Flowers, which was later became Maroon 5, and you know, all these other kind of groups.
Wow.
And we headlined. You know, these were groups that were opening for us locally and stuff. And so there's a little small amount of success that way. But instead of thinking that it was going to be everything that I wanted and having people like me and having girls that rejected me in high school suddenly have an interest in me, it really made me feel disconnected and strange. It freaked me out taking pictures of people who didn't know me. Mm-hmm. It was weird. I don't really know what it was, but I think I was also newly starting to get clean at that point. It was in my early 20s.
It's a freak out time.
And it was just a real, real bad thing to be getting to know myself and deconstructing while trying to play these kind of shows. And I freaked out and I stopped playing music for about 12 years. I probably played guitar once a year for about 12 years.
The day the music died.
It was. It really, really was.
Hmm.
It was only, you know, years after I got divorced and you know, all these other things that happened in the meantime, that one day I just plugged in and started playing again about 5 years ago. And I've been doing it every day since. But there's this song that John Lennon wrote about his time in exile. And people, my friends, would always associate me with music. And my friends would always ask me if I'm okay in that whole period of time where I wasn't playing. They say, are you all right? You know, you're not playing any music. Like, you can't be happy. You don't seem happy. And the truth is, I wasn't happy. I was very unhappy. But this sort of thing that I put out there, it wasn't because of the music. It was because I was just not dealing with stuff that was in me. So there's this John Lennon song that was sort of a theme of mine for a while. So.
People say I'm crazy.
So at the time, you know, I had a young son, you know, much like John Lennon, you know, taking a hiatus and raising a little boy, and was going through a divorce, and marriage didn't last long. It was a really bad idea, and no reason to get into that here. But,
yes, ideas.
So people would always assume that I was not okay, and I was like, well, you know, I have this little person I'm trying to raise, I'm trying to instill life lessons, and I'm trying to be a functional human being myself. And the least of my concerns is the fact that people aren't cheering me on what I'm doing wow. on a stage somewhere. Part of that is that was never a reason for me doing it anyway, other than when I was an 8-year-old kid and I dreamed about it, you know, with a tennis racket. But it was actually really, really good for me because not playing music for a long time. I mean, I always wrote. I'm a writer too, and I have a really weird haiku addiction. But I do. It's the weirdest thing
in
the world.
It's amazing. It's the funnest thing to wake up to.
I write haiku every day. It's the weirdest. And I don't know why. I was never influenced. I mean, you know.
That's like autistic a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. When I was younger, I spent so much time on my own.
I wonder, yeah.
That I think that I would have been put on that spectrum in some way.
I think probably, maybe so.
You know, because I was into that, and I was into music, and I was into baseball. And when I was younger, I still have these notebooks where fantasy sports is this huge thing now.
Yeah.
I kept these crazy, crazy averages of everybody in the major leagues. And
wild.
Like, I mean, I could have told you at that time what the backup third baseman for the Kansas City Royals hit the year before. It was just one of those things that I dove into. And that's not a normal thing to do for a 7-year-old, but it made sense for me.
It makes sense, though, because that's what you talked to your dad about.
Yeah.
So you wanted to know.
Yeah.
You were in the know.
And I think there is part of that. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that was a way to fill the hours without him in my life because I didn't come home. Weekends were great because I would actually spend time with him and then see my grandfather on the weekends. And that would be the time where I could get out and do things with my dad, assuming that he wasn't hungover and
Yeah. What's your son's name?
Coltrane.
Your son's name is Coltrane.
My son's name is Coltrane.
Yes. Dude, Cole for short, Train for short.
You know,
or just Coltrane.
He usually just goes by Coltrane. He really does.
And I mean, he's how old now, junior?
He's 10. He's almost 11.
10, 11. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, he's an interesting kid. He's a really interesting kid. You know, guitar is to him what it was to me at that age, but he's ahead of me, so it's good.
We're winding down number 5555.
Yeah. One of my favorite bands is a band called Drive-By Truckers. I've loved this band for a long time. I think Patterson Hood's a great songwriter. And this year has been a really weird year. This last year, 2016, I shouldn't say the last 3 weeks have been a weird year.
But
it's been a really strange year. It's a year, election years are always really contentious anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think that the viciousness with which I see people communicate with one another online and the idea that people can't seem to hear one another and the idea that people are sometimes so quick to judge people, and it bothers me so much to see that, to see people that I know and love and respect treat other people that way. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you've had any of those sort of experiences this year, but there's people that you know and you see them say something and you go, what the fuck? That is vicious. That is hateful. That is brutal.
That's because there's no consequences on the internet.
Right. That's probably true. So we can either be grown-ups and figure out a way together to face forward and deal with these things, or we can sit back in fear and lash out at people who are different. And
the latter sounds a lot easier.
It does. And so there's this song here on this new record where he says he doesn't really know what these things mean, but these things are happening nonetheless. And he wrote it about everything from the George Zimmerman situation that happened in Florida with Trayvon Martin to a number of other racially motivated incidents. And I think it's a pretty phenomenal song.
And who is it?
What is
the Drive-By Truckers.
Drive-By Truckers, that's right.
And the song is called What It Means.
What It Means, Drive-By Truckers.
Shot him in his tracks. About the only thing agreed upon is he ain't coming back. There won't be any trial, so the air won't be clear. There's just two sides calling names out of anger, out of fear. And if you say it wasn't racial when they shot him in his tracks, well, I guess that means that you ain't black. It means that you ain't black.
Wow. Goose pimples.
Yeah.
Beautiful. His voice is absolutely beautiful. His accent is wonderful.
For a bunch of white men in Alabama.
I love to hear that accent and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And love
it. One of the things that I think is so interesting to hear somebody from Alabama with that rich southern accent sing these songs is, I think it adds something to the music. You know, he talks about when he debuted it in the South and people started walking out of his shows. They didn't know how to handle it. And race remains a very divisive issue in our culture. You know, I mean,
it's very clear what the target audience is.
But
because
I'm
not sure that this is, you know, a voice for African Americans. I don't think that that's what it's for.
Yeah, I don't think that he would probably say that it was for that. I think it's called What It Means because he says over and over again, don't ask me what it means. Like, I know this is fucked up. This is really fucked up. And we don't seem to want to face what these issues are. And it's just two sides calling names, casting aspersions to one another rather viciously. And how do you make sense of that? How do you make sense, again, when I was saying you can't save the people if you don't serve the people, I mean, how do you, if you're going to be a leader, not just a president, but anywhere else, you know, understanding the needs of people who have been marginalized, who feel like their voices have not been heard, is a part of being a leader, and it's a part of being a grown human being.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I just hang around with people who believe the way that I believe, I mean, I'm fairly libertarian, you know? So if I just hang around with people who are other libertarians, well, first of all, it's a pretty small group of people.
Right.
And beyond all of that, I wouldn't be able to evolve past my narrow ideology.
I'm largely conservative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's same. I think it's kind of in the same vein, you know, raised by hippies as a flower child.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What the fuck is going on?
Just all kinds of confusion, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, where does that put us now as a society that, you know, should probably establish an end game for conversations before we start conversations? You know, it's easy to get a conversation going, but in this medium, I think especially social media, for myself, I'm thinking I should establish a closing statement before I start talking, like, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
I love you, and you are a big part of my life,
mm-hmm.
and I remember you, and I remember how we met, and I remember laughing, and because you mentioned you disagreed with protesters and made statements that weren't comfortable to me, now I don't talk to you. I defriended
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that, and me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm part of this fucking problem.
Mm-hmm.
And this drive-by truckers song, I mean, the people walked out, they were listening.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a positive there.
Mm-hmm.
If you walked out, you fucking listened to those words.
Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty risky thing to do too if you're a white artist in the Deep South from Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Pretty dangerous thing to do to come at the establishment, if you will, in that way and make them. You know what I think is interesting is he doesn't really drive home a political point so much as say that these things are happening and we're not talking about it. You're running to your side of the aisle, and you are just throwing the most vicious things that you possibly can at everybody else. And it's out of anger and fear, as he says. And at what point are we no longer going to be afraid of these things? I mean, at what point are we going to have this conversation? I mean, the fact that in 2017, we're still having these conversations is really, really disheartening to me. I remember thinking not just about racism in particular, but that we're moving beyond all of those things years ago. I thought as a kid that would not be the kind of world that I grew up in. And thankfully, for as much as people criticize millennials, they seem to have that kind of stuff figured out a lot better than people my age. Millennials they don't get hung up on those same things and those same fears for the most part.
It certainly got talked about. My mom, when I was 7 years old, older brother, younger sister, married an African-American man with mm-hmm. three kids. And I was raised partially in mixed race household.
Mm-hmm.
And got to see grandparents react, got to see African-Americans like my grandparents react. And, you know, one of the memories that I have, my stepbrother Bill and I in New York together, should there be a conversation about an apartment, I would be the one to meet the landlord because I'm mm-hmm. white.
Right.
We got complacent, I think, and we were kind of felt comfortable with King's work and other stuff and civil rights. And we're like, okay, we've mm-hmm. talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're now at the action step.
Yeah.
You know?
But what does that look like?
That's the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
This
what does
is
that
a
look
very
like?
Scary step, and I hope it doesn't look like a fucking barrel of a gun.
Well,
I'm so fucking afraid we're going to start shooting each other. I'm really fucking afraid of that.
Yeah, I think that there needs to be a way to have these conversations, and I don't know who can be some sort of moderator that can facilitate these kinds of conversations.
You can.
I don't know.
You know, I mean, you can.
Well, you know, one of the things that I thought was really, really interesting about this election, not to keep this political, but I was not someone who was stumping for Hillary Clinton. I was not in any way, shape, or form. And yet every time I questioned anything about our current president, about the lack of kindness that he seemed to show, the lack of compassion for the people that he wanted to lead, that's the only thing that I got thrown back at me. You know, well, Hillary, and I said, I'm not talking about Hillary Clinton. I'm not voting for Hillary Clinton. But people didn't seemed to know what to do with me. They wanted to put me in one box or mm-hmm. another, and it was the strangest thing. I again felt like I was in the Twilight Zone. And I said, I don't even want to talk about the people. I want to talk about the issues that we're talking about. And I don't remember a time in my adult life where it was so difficult to have a conversation with people.
This has
just
been
Googling.
The most Y-Y-Tune shuffle we've had today. This is a very good Y-Tune shuffle. We're left with more Ys.
I know. Let's get to your favorite part, David.
My favorite part of the show. Maggie and my show. God love you.
What was your very first concert?
ever.
Oh, wow. Okay. So my very
back to the music.
Yeah. My very first concert, believe it or not, was when a couple of my aunts took my cousin and myself to see Michael Jackson and his brothers who came out with him on the Victory Tour. It was like a Jackson 5 Victory Tour. So that's the first one that I remember.
That's awesome.
That I remember. I have scattered memories of that of that show, but it was interesting.
My dad's got the best first concert.
What was that?
Bill Haley and the Comets.
One, two, three.
What I would give for that.
I mean, there's footage on YouTube of those guys, but concerts are just so amazing. They're always amazing.
And again, look what a guitar means. That just that 1, 2, 3 o'clock, just coming at that. That was revolutionary.
Yeah.
People were angry when they heard that song.
There's concert footage in Berlin where those German kids went ape shit.
Yeah.
And tore that place apart.
Right.
Wow.
Shake, rattle, and roll, and it just went nuts.
Yeah. That's the problem, I think, with being a singer-songwriter and playing acoustic guitar. You never get that sort of, I'm never going to start a riot, which is really, really sad. It's my bucket list. But
to start a riot?
Yeah, start a riot.
Well, let's end on that happy note.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Ryan Duggan, can we find you? How do we find you online?
Well, you can go to my website, which is ryanpatrickduggan.com. There's email connections to me there. You can find me on Twitter if you want, tweeting about Adam Lambert and my various hatred for
that's a chapter in Media Literacy 101.
That would be the best way to find me, unless you want to listen to KFI every night. You can listen to me there.
That too.
Coast to Coast AM.
This has been such a thrill, because that's why I know you from KFI. Like, there's the guy. Here's that dude from the radio.
You know what's interesting, though? It's cool that you're a KFI listener, but a lot of people who are hardcore KFI Coast to Coast listeners engage me with conversations about secret governments. Things of the sort. And I'm like, if you want to know about what's going on in the 405, I'm your guy. Yeah. If you want to know about...
Well, I commute, so both are equally important to me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. It was fantastic.
Good.